Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and welcome back to the Film Literature in the New World Order podcast for the month of October 2016. As promised last month, we are going to be talking about the film Being There, directed by Hal Ashby, starring Peter Sellers, based on the book by Jerzy Kosinski. And what an interesting movie it is. Quite a change of pace from last month's edition of the series, where we were talking about The Purge election year. Here we have a very interesting and worthwhile movie. So I hope you did watch the movie in preparation for this conversation. And if you did so, you will be suitably rewarded by our guest and his insights. Our guest should be familiar, I think, to a large portion of the Corbett Report audience. He is Julian Charles of The Mind Renewed at themindrenewed.com, and people might be familiar with him from nothing else if not his interviews of myself, which are in the archives. I'll include the links in the show notes for this conversation in case you're interested, because he is an excellent interviewer in his own right, and I think brings out the best in his interview subjects. So I'm hoping to turn the microphone around on him and put him under the spotlight a little bit today. Julian, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us.
Well, thank you very much, James, for inviting me on. And you shouldn't say that I'm going to enlighten people, because I don't think I am. I maybe know what I'm doing now with interviewing, but I'm not sure that I know what I'm doing when it comes to talking at length about a movie.
Well, let's find out. Actually, yeah. this movie was really recommended to me by yourself on your podcast. You had a conversation where you were talking about various movies and pop culture works and how they relate to these types of subject matters that we often talk about in our respective programs. And you talked about the film Being There, which I had not seen at the time that I was listening to your podcast, but it sounded intriguing enough that I gave it a try, and lo and behold, it really is. It's a well-made film. It's a very interesting film. It stands on its own, and I think it has some very interesting commentary on the subject of how the world really works and what really lies behind the world of politics, even if it does so in a lighthearted way. I'm not even sure if that's the right way of framing it, but I'll turn this over to you. Why did this movie catch your attention, and why did you bring it to the attention of your own podcast audience?
I see what you mean about it being lighthearted. I do think it's a kind of it's kind of one big joke in a way all the way through the film. But it's not just a piece of comedy, is it? There is a depth to it, which no doubt we'll go to in this conversation. I mean, the thing that really sort of made me want to talk about it, and I'm happy to talk with you about it today, is I suppose, to be quite honest, it's the ending of the film, which comes as such a shock, really, because of the symbolism that's there and casts light upon one's understanding of what one has seen so far in the film. So, I mean, at the ending, you have the character called Benjamin Rand, who is this oligarch, essentially, and he has died, and there is his funeral that's taking place, and the President of the United States is giving this eulogy, but he's also quoting from Ben Rand's comments, which are quite amusing in their own right. And as this is going on, you have the pallbearers carrying this coffin towards the, I guess it's the family tomb, or maybe family in an extended esoteric sense, I don't know, but it's shaped like a pyramid, and at the top it has this eye of Horus, and you think, what on earth is going on here? And as that coffin is going towards the tomb, there are these people who seem to be their elitist individuals. They're obviously kingmakers or president choosers, and they're having this very quiet conversation as they're carrying the coffin. Who is going to be the next president of the United States? And they're whispering backwards and forwards in there. And they're saying, well, we can't really have the same guy, you know. How about this main character of the movie, who is called Chance? And we'll talk about him in a few minutes, no doubt. And they're basically saying, well, you know, we don't know anything about Chance. He doesn't seem to have a history. He doesn't have a past. He hasn't got anything that anybody could blackmail him with. He's ideal. He's a non-entity. We can sort of paint him as we like. Yes, let's have him. Let's put him forward. He's our man. And obviously the film goes on, and there are some further jokes, which we'll discuss in a minute. But I just thought that scene opens up a window into one's interpretation of the whole movie. And kind of in retrospect, you realize this one big joke that's been going on is a commentary upon power and class and privilege and all these things, and how we as people who are involved in the societies that we live in are influenced by opinion makers and the media, and our thoughts, our own thoughts, are we molded by what we see and therefore interpret those who are presented to us as power figures and politicians and the like? Are we molded in that interpretation to say, oh, these are really important people. Yes, I'm going to give them my vote and that sort of thing. The whole thing is like a load of questions that I think are, that come through that final scene. That's how it works for me anyway. And, so that's essentially what made me really interested in the movie, to answer your question.
That is an excellent analysis, and I agree completely with your experience of the end of the film, changing your perception of the beginning or the what has come before. I think all of those elements were there, the satire, the commentary were there, but they did seem more like a joke, like a type of comedy that was playing out, until that ending scene in which it's really more thrust into your face what this is really gesturing towards. And then, of course, the final image, interesting in and of itself, where he walks out onto the water. And again, we'll probably circle back to that. But you do gesture to the fact that this is centering around this character named Chance the Gardener. And for the naughty listeners in the audience who haven't seen the movie, perhaps we can just go a little bit into a summarization of who is Chance the Gardener and how does he stumble into this strange world of political kingmakers?
Yeah, okay, well, I'll try to be as brief as I can about this. Okay, so we have this character called Chance, which is a rather interesting name, and it's played by Peter Sellers, one of my heroes. And he's kind of this, he's a sort of simple-minded, I don't know whether I like that phrase, but that's how most people, I think, describe him. Simple-minded, middle-aged man, roughly about 50 years old, you know, and he lives in this well-appointed house in Washington, D.C. with a character called the Old Man, who you don't get to see until the Old Man's on his deathbed. And he also lives with this black maid called Louise, who provides Chance with his food, and he spent his whole life right from a child in this house. He's never left the house. And interestingly, he spends most of his time doing one of two things, or in fact, two things at the same time very often: watching TV and tending the walled garden of the house. And that's it, basically, apart from normal bodily functions, etc. And, you know, we don't really know in the film why he's there. We know more in the book, actually. His mother died at birth, and the old man will not tell him who the father was. So he's been there right from birth, really. And he gets all of his information about the world from watching television and from interacting with the garden. So he's everything for him is only real if it appears as flickering things on the television or the natural cycles going on with the seasons. That's basically it. And in the book it says, this is a little quote here: as long as one didn't look at people, they did not exist. Of course, this is speaking from within his mind. They began to exist, as on TV, when one turned one's eyes on them. So that's how he saw the world. And, you know, when I first saw this movie, you know, you can imagine just from what I've described there that it seemed really sad, really depressing. That's how it came over. Because it's, you know, it starts with this middle-aged man in bed, and Schubert's Unfinished Symphony is being played on this TV screen that's in his bedroom. That's quite an interesting choice of music there. There's lots of interesting music that's chosen for this film. So it's the Unfinished Symphony, so perhaps saying something about this unfinished character. Anyway, he just wakes up and he looks blankly at the screen, and it's like super realist exploration of what it is to be really lonely and depressed. That's how the film comes over. But as it goes on, it becomes more clear that it's this gradually unfolding joke, and at the same time a deeper commentary throughout the film. It's a very weird experience I found. Anyway, so the old man dies, and this character Chance doesn't really understand what's going on, and he's asked by lawyers, does he want to make a claim against the house? Does he want to state how it is he's been living here all these years. He's got any proof that he was employed as a gardener, et cetera, et cetera. And he hasn't got any proof of anything whatsoever. He doesn't seem to have any history, no birth certificate or anything. And so he has to leave the house. He goes out into the real world, as it were. And there's more in the film at this point than there is in the book. But he because he's so addicted to television, he walks by a television shop and he, for the first time, sees himself in a television that's actually in the window of the shop because there's CCTV that's recording him. And that's a kind of illumination. Well, it should be an illumination moment for him. It should be a sort of self-awareness moment. But, of course, it isn't really, because he is this weird kind of blank character. So he's not just simple-minded. He's really a blank, like a slate upon which people can write, which I think is quite an important point in the whole movie. So there's this kind of turning point in the film, but as this happens, he just stumbles backwards and he's knocked by the limousine of the wife of an oligarch, essentially, and she's very concerned that he might want to claim against the family, or perhaps bring the family into disrepute. So she's very concerned about him, takes him back to the big mansion where the oligarch lives, Mr. Rand, Benjamin Rand, and her name is Eve in the film, although E.E. in the book. Benjamin Rand is very impressed by this character, because essentially he just writes on to this blank character called Chance, his own prejudices and his own desires and his own way of looking at the world. And Chance, who's now called Chancey Gardner, and I'll have to explain why, in the limousine while going to the house, Peter Sellers, Chance is offered a drink of brandy in the car by Eve, and he accepts, and because he's not familiar with alcoholic beverages at all. And so she asks him, what's your name? And he says, well, he's about to say Chance, of course, Chance the Gardener, but he sputters on this alcohol, and she thinks he says Chancey Gardner. So she writes on her own misunderstanding of him onto his character, just like everybody else does in the film. And Benjamin Rand is very impressed by this blank character who he mistakes for a businessman. And then the film goes on with Chance unwittingly going up the social ladder, meeting the president of the United States, going on television, being the actual population of the United States really impressed by this guy who talks supposedly knowledgeably about the economy, although all the time he's actually referring to the garden, because that's what he's familiar with. He talks about the seasons and plants growing in the garden, and that's misunderstood as a metaphor for the economy. So eventually there's this kind of romantic attachment between Rand's wife and Chancey Gardner, essentially because the dying Rand, who has got this rare blood disease, wants his wife to be happy and encourages her to form a romantic attachment to Chancey Gardner, who he's so impressed with. And you can see that this character is just being built up, this blank is being built up and up and up, and to the point where, of course, Benjamin Rand does eventually die, and it looks like Chance is somehow going to take over the whole estate, and as we said at the beginning of the conversation, gets tipped to be the next president of the United States by this sort of esoteric group of elitists. Right at the end, then there is this business of him walking out onto the water. And that's something that people have criticized, because it does seem to be a big change in the movie there. It's as if he's no longer a blank slate who is misunderstood by everybody. Now he is... Well, what's the director saying? That he is actually some sort of guru? It's a weird moment,
right,
at that point.
Or it could be a commentary to the effect of, well, these people who come along in history and talk about gardening metaphors and are put on pedestals as superhumans, or maybe a commentary on that. But at any rate, it is such a very jarring way to end the movie. I mean, it's not like that is the point at which we are forced to suspend disbelief. Clearly, the entire movie has been quite silly in a lot of ways, but it has certainly adhered to most, physical principles, if nothing else. And that is such moment of real change in the tone that, as we say, I think is contributory to that experience of going back and having to sort of reevaluate your sense of what the movie was about. Because I think you're right, it does build up as a type of joke, and if it was a broad joke, one would expect that he would be forced into a situation where he would be exposed and he wouldn't know what to say and everything would come crashing down, or perhaps he would, somehow say just the right thing again and, propagate him to a different sphere or whatever. But I think the story ends at just the right place, at the point at which they're going to try to do this. I don't want to see them, trying to thrust him onto the political stage and all of that. I don't think that would have been a much broader satire. But I think
that would have been terrible. I agree with you. Yeah.
But I think we do have to try to pin this down to some sort of genre, at least to try to make sense of what's happening here. And I think satire is the appropriate framing device for this. And I'll actually point listeners to to Roger Ebert's evaluation of the film from his Great Movies collection. He wrote this in 1997, so almost 20 years after the movie came out. And I think he pointed out quite aptly what this movie is essentially about, although there are obviously many tangents here. But he says, satire is a threatened species in American film, and when it does occur, it's usually broad and slapstick, as in the Mel Brooks films. Being There, directed by Hal Ashby, is a rare and subtle bird that finds its tone and stays with it. It has the appeal of an ingenious intellectual game, in which the hero survives a series of challenges he doesn't understand, using words that are both universal and meaningless. But are chance of sayings noticeably less useful than when the president tells us about a bridge to the 21st century? Sensible public speech in our time is limited by 1, the need to stay within the confines of the 10-second TV soundbite, 2, the desire to avoid being pinned down to specific claims or promises, and 3, the abbreviated attention span of the audience, which, like chance, likes to watch, but always has a channel changer poised. If chance's little slogans reveal how superficial public utterance can be, his reception reveals still more. Because he is WASP, middle-aged, well-groomed, dressed in tailored suits, and speaks like an educated man, he is automatically presumed to be a person of substance. He is, in fact, socially naive. You're always going to be a little boy, Louise tells him. But this leads to a directness that can be mistaken for confidence, as when he addresses the president by his first name or enfolds his hands in both of his own. The movie argues that if you look right, sound right, speak in platitudes, and have powerful friends, you can go far in our society. And I think this points out at least two important aspects of what's going on in this satire, one of which is the appearance really does make the man, and people will assume so much from the appearance and the way someone presents themselves to you. And the other part is the way the medium is the message, and in the TV-dominated 10-second TV soundbite era of reporting and understanding our world, it really is meaningless, universal, vague, comfortably appealing statements like talking about the economy in terms of a garden that has the most appeal to the widest audience and thus will become the most politically popular. I think that's obviously, I think, two of the prongs of this satire. And I just want to see what you think about the idea of framing this as broadly a satire.
I think so. You have, in a sense, covered what I'm about to say, but perhaps just stretch it a little bit further, in that I think it's also a parable, a satirical parable, that is a bit of a warning to us as well. So you have that business about the medium and the message, as you've been talking about. And I think, actually, one of the things it's saying to us is that the images that we receive through television in particular, but obviously not just that, when they are controlled by those who perhaps should not be in control of them, they are actually conditioning us to interpret the world in a certain way. So we're not just watching those images in a controlled way ourselves necessarily. We're receiving those passively, so that when we see somebody who is dressed the right way, talks the right way, etc., we are tempted to evaluate those people as we've been conditioned to evaluate them. So I think it's a warning for all of us that, who controls the media is actually controlling our perception of those that they're actually putting forward into positions of power. And because they look right, we'll say, oh, yes, that's who I'm. That's the kind of person I would expect to be in power. I will give them my assent. That's just a little extension.
I think another aspect of that is that it seems to be a commentary on the richest and most powerful people in some ways seem to be the easiest to fool because they are expecting, they are projecting their own wit, acumen, intelligence, whatever, onto this blank slate in a way that perhaps someone like Louise, the maid, would not. And there is that poignant scene where Chance ends up on TV through a ridiculous series of events, and she says, look, it's a white man's world. You know, he's as stupid as a child, and he's up on TV talking to the president. So there's certainly that commentary going on as well. But let's get into the meat and potatoes then. If this does, of course, revolve around Benjamin Rand, what an interesting choice of name for that character, Rand.
Absolutely.
Of course. And this oligarch industrialist, I would say that one of the, I mean, I don't think it's a direct parallel or anything, but perhaps one of the templates for Rand would be a Rockefeller, John D. Rockefeller Sr., who in fact was buried in a cemetery or interred in a cemetery with a giant obelisk on top. And you can go and visit the John D. Rockefeller obelisk where people lay dimes because, of course, he was famous for having carefully staged PR events towards the end of his life, giving out dimes to young children because he was such a wonderful old man. But yes, there's this giant obelisk, Egyptian obelisk at his gravesite, which one wonders if anyone has really thought about the significance thereof. But at any rate, it's put quite in your face in a very visceral way in this film, as you say. Obviously, this is one of the oligarchical rulers of the United States. He says, I've been described as a kingmaker. He meets with the president and tells, you know, gives him advice on his speech and things like this. So we start to see a bit of that. And then, of course, as you say, in the final scene with the pallbearers, ultimately deciding who will be the next president of the United States and trying to decide on Chance the Gardener, or kind of seeming to decide on Chance the Gardener, precisely because he doesn't seem to have much of a past, which, of course, again, is another, I think, commentary, which so much of this movie, I think, resonates even more a couple of decades later. There's the aspect of the dumbing down of society through the television medium as the way of portraying this in little sound bites, which I think is obviously played out and is obviously coming to fruition with this reality TV show of a selection cycle in 2016 in the United States. But also the idea of a relative unknown with a murky past, well, that's all the better because you can't really, you know, drudge anything up from his past, seems to have been what played out essentially with the Hope and Change takeover of 2008 with Barack Obama, who has a relatively murky past and has a lot of secrecy surrounding a lot of his early years in childhood and even his university career. Mm-hmm. Big question marks over that, which were never really solved. And still...
No, could I...
Yes, please.
I dragged up a quote, actually, because I thought that was in my mind as well. And I don't know whether people have read it, but there is an article written in 2013 by Wayne Allen Root called Barack Obama, the Ghost of Columbia University. And there's a paragraph here, which I think is absolutely fascinating. Do you mind if I read it?
Please go ahead.
All right. I just returned from New York, where I attended my 30th Columbia University reunion. I celebrated with my esteemed classmates, everyone except Barack Obama. As usual, he wasn't there. Not even a video greeting, not a personalized letter to his classmates, nothing. But worse, no one in our 30th reunion ever met him. The President of the United States is the ghost of Columbia University. I am a graduate of Columbia University, class of 1983. That's the same class Barack Obama claims to have graduated from. We shared the same exact major, political science. We're both pre-law. It was a small class, about 700 students. The political science department was even smaller and closer-knit, maybe 150 students. I thought I knew or met at least once, or certainly saw in classes, every fellow poli-sci classmate in my 4 years at Columbia, but not Obama. No one ever met him. Even worse, no one even remembers seeing that unique, memorable face. Think about that for a minute. Our classmate is President of the United States. Shouldn't someone remember him, or at least claim to remember him? It's an amazing paragraph.
It puts it in perspective, doesn't it? And it really does seem a Chance the Gardener type of situation, which I think, again, it's the phenomenon of satire. Of ultimately, if you live long enough, you will see the satire come to literal fruition in a lot of cases.
although strangely, he's a kind of sort of a mix between George W. and Obama, isn't he? He has the, as it were, the simplicity of George W., but the obscurity of Obama.
Indeed, yes. Well, so I think that, I mean, clearly there's that aspect of it going on, but let's look at some of the underlying basis for this world of being there, which is clearly run by these oligarchical figures, these industrialists. And you note that you had read the book version of this?
I have, yes, that's right.
Can you talk about some of the differences? Is that aspect of it fleshed out in any more detail in the book version?
Less detail. Certainly. I mean, at the end, there isn't the scene that, you know, as I said, really inspired me to, you know, want to talk about this movie. Well, that scene isn't there in the book. There's a bit of it. There's a little meeting between, they're clearly people of great influence, and I think they're talking about who should be the next vice president. But it's a very short chapter at the end, and it's not at the funeral, and there's no walking on water or anything like that. So although actually I do think the film is very faithful to the book, but they've extended it slightly, extended some of those themes, and obviously they've had to change things to make it work cinematically, but I think it's pretty faithful.
Interesting. Yeah. Do you know anything about Jerzy Kosinski's biography?
I know a few things. I mean, he's a Polish-American novelist. He had Jewish parents. I mean, he was therefore around the time of the Second World War, living with his family in a state of fear, and they were helped by local people. Catholic priest helped them forged a baptismal certificate for him, and so they did escape the Holocaust because of this help they received. So, and there are a number of things about his life which I think suggest that he saw in Chauncey Gardner something autobiographical, perhaps. I'll come back to that in a second. Only slightly. I mean, he studied history. He became an academic of sorts. He served in the Polish army. He wanted to get out of the Soviet bloc area. So he forged some letters from non-existent Soviet authorities, and he created a fake foundation that would sponsor him to go abroad. And he managed to get out. He then did odd jobs in the US. I think he drove a truck for a while, but he then retrained at Columbia University, funnily enough, and he won lots of grants to do writing. He then actually became a lecturer in the States as well, even places like Yale, Princeton, other universities. He married this is interesting, an American steel heiress in 1962. She then died and left him out of her will. And then he married again, and this is also interesting, a member of the Bavarian nobility. Mm-hmm. So you know what I mean? He had a very strange...
Well, an extremely unlikely biography in some ways, and made all the more unlikely because apparently he was a congenital liar who not many people were ever able really to come to the truth or falsity of a lot of the stories he told about his earlier life. Or even his ongoing life. I get this from a couple of different sources that I want to just talk a little bit about, because they do touch on those interesting parts of his biography. There's an article from 2007 called The Rise and Fall of Jerzy Kosinski, which is written by Philip Routh, which notes his marriage, as you say, to Mary Howard Weir, the widow of a steel magnate, who had come to admire his academic writing, and that led to their first meeting, and she employed him to catalog the books in her library, and they ended up getting married for a few years anyway. But that's when he apparently was introduced to some of the types of figures that perhaps he was satirizing in Being There, including Henry Kissinger, who was perhaps one of the people that he hobnobbed with. This, again, from The Rise and Fall of Jerzy Kosinski, quote, "Away from the public spotlight at dinner and cocktail parties held in New York penthouses, Kosinski was on a first-name basis with the famous Henry Kissinger, fashion designer Oscar De La Renta, theater critic John Simon, Senator Jacob Javits, and also with the anonymous bankers and industrialists whose decisions drive the world's economy. He was often the center of attention, for he had the gift of beguiling. And it gets even stranger from there, in fact. There was a biography that came out in 1996 that was reviewed in the Los Angeles Times by Julia Block Frey called Lying, A Life Story, the biography of Jerzy Kosinski. And that review opens by saying, he loved to tell outrageous lies, particularly to the rich, intellectual, and famous. They were so eager to be entertained, he explained, that they willingly suspended disbelief, and they were so confident of their superiority that they deserved to be played for fools. Court gesture to his powerful American friends. That's how Jerzy Kosinski sometimes referred to himself. So we have a man who seemed to be bragging about pulling the wool over the eyes of the likes of Henry Kissinger and, you know, anonymous bankers and industrialists, because they are easily played for fools, because they tend to think of themselves as superior, and thus they can't be fooled by mere, you know, Polish immigrant like this guy. I think there must be some truth to that idea. I don't know about the stories per se of what particularly he was saying to them, but the idea that these types of rich and powerful people are probably the easiest to dupe because they are so full of themselves and so confident in their own abilities. I think that probably plays a large part in the type of satire we see playing out in the movie. Anyway, I haven't read the book myself, so I don't know how biting that satire is, but it certainly does play a pretty large role in the movie.
Yes, that's absolutely right, yes. I mean, Benjamin Rand himself is exactly that, isn't he? He's kidding himself, there's no doubt about it. He is seeing in chance what he wants to see. You know, I think that actually, you know, when I go back to some of these quotes here by Kosinski, it is interesting that it bears out some of the things that you've just said there. I mean, I have here, let me just quote here, as I have no habits that I require maintaining, I don't even have a favorite menu. The only way for me to live is to be as close to other people as life allows. Not much else stimulates me, and nothing interests me more. So he did have this very keen interest in studying other people. And then he goes on, and this is another quote from him, writing fiction is the essence of my life. Whatever else I do revolves around a constant thought. Could I, can I, would I, should I use it in my next novel? I have no children, no family, no relatives, no business or estate to speak of. My books are my only spiritual accomplishment. And no doubt there's hyperbole there, you know, but I get the impression from that he was living inside a novelization process throughout his life, you know, and doing what, in a sense, his satire being there criticizes other people for doing. I think he did it himself.
Indeed. Well, there's another layer to this onion, because apparently there is significant question about Kosinski's own authorship of this book and the other books that he wrote.
That's right.
Because it came out in the 1980s, The Village Voice and others started to uncover the fact that he had used editors, in quotation marks, for his books that may or may not have been ghostwriters, or may not have, at the very least, translated his books from Polish into English, because apparently he could barely spell or write in English. And so that might have been another aspect of this pulling the wool over everyone's eyes. It's never been, I think, definitively determined that these books were all ghostwritten, but certainly the suggestion is there, and some of these editors have come forward saying that they did work with him. And the idea is that he had the ideas for the stories, but basically they were fleshed out by these essentially ghostwriters who were paid by him to do it.
Well, that is very interesting, because he's also being accused of plagiarizing ideas.
Yes,
so
yes.
Maybe he didn't even have the idea as well, which is fascinating, because there is this a book called The Career of Nicodem Dismas.
Yes.
I don't know how you pronounce that.
Yes.
Which is very popular over in Poland, apparently. So, I mean, just looking at the rundown of the story here in very brief, there are so many similarities to the Chance character. So an unemployed man from the sticks goes to Warsaw to find work. He finds a lost invitation to a high society party. He's got this tuxedo, so he decides, well, I can go to that. So he goes to that, and he meets an MP who is impressed by him, and he impresses lots of people. He's then introduced to a rich landowner who was a former con man, and that landowner makes him manager of his estate. Then the rich man's wife falls in love with him, and thereafter he rises up the social ladder, political ladder. So you know, there are loads of similarities there. It's very suspicious.
Indeed. It's very interesting. And in fact, it almost seems like perhaps we, sitting here and analyzing this story in terms of Kwasinski's biography, may be the final people to be made fools of by Kwasinski, in a sense. This is all a stolen story that he didn't even write anyway.
Yes, it's all folding in on itself, isn't it? It's getting bizarre experience.
Indeed. Well, then, okay, let's circle back then to the operative part of this story for us, and I'm sure the audience out there. This idea of the oligarchs who want to put in the most convenient political puppet from their perspective, obviously for controlling the economy from behind the scenes, controlling the country from behind the scenes, and then this final image of Chance walking out into the water, onto the water, as if he were a Christ-like figure. Now, how do we situate ourselves in that? What do we, as the audience, what should we take away from this? Is this simply someone with perhaps potentially some insider knowledge of the people who really run things behind the scenes in the United States, trying to lift the veil on that curtain? But then again, as you say, that wasn't even particularly part of the book. It was added for the film version. Is this meant to be is this meant in a way to undermine that idea? Oh, this is just silly. Look at how silly this is. And look at how, he's walking on water. It's clearly just all a metaphor for something. This isn't how things really work. What is the effect of this on A, the general audience, and B, what should we take away from it as more informed audience, I hope?
Good heavens. That's a huge question. And of course, I'm going to say, perhaps I overstated it. I don't remember now. No, there is something of this critique of the oligarchy in the book. I just don't think it's as stark as it is in the film. It's just extended in the film, but it's certainly there. But therefore, perhaps, in that it isn't quite so much of the book, perhaps one would be justified in thinking that was less of the original idea. That might be true. It's very difficult to say what would be the take-home message about the book, because it's working on so many different levels. There are so many different things that are being said. I mean, there are so many commentaries on this film out there with wildly different ideas. I mean, I came across an esoteric reading of the film, which I didn't find at all convincing. In fact, so unconvincing, I can't even remember anything about it, to be honest. But, you know, people do pick up on different elements of it, and there is also, I mean, it is related to the main point that we've already discussed about the film, but it's a kind of sub idea which has to do with some quasi religious symbolism, and of course the presence of Nietzsche's critique of morality and religion is also in there. But I don't think it's particularly Nietzschean either. I don't know if you want to discuss all that kind of thing, but I mean, there are references to 2001, which has the music of Also Sprach Zarathustra, Strauss's tone poem, working on the idea of the work by Nietzsche, and etc. There are loads of themes in there.
In fact, I did note that as it was playing. I thought, why on earth are they? They're clearly evoking in the history of cinema when you hear that theme, you were clearly thinking of 2001, but I couldn't figure out exactly what role it was playing in the movie at that point. As I recall, that's when he first leaves the house and is basically walking around Washington, D.C. for the first time and seeing its dilapidated state, and suddenly Zarathustra is playing in the background. I didn't really understand the significance of that reference.
Well, I can't claim to have a full understanding of it. I can only, you know, sort of share with you the ideas that have been, you know, I've formulated provisionally about it. So, I mean, this music is, as I say, from Richard Strauss's tone poem. This is just the beginning of it, which people will be familiar with that fanfare music, but it's reworked as a sort of jazz funk style by the composer of the film. And I think that's done partly because he's coming out into the real world and he's had this sheltered sort of upper middle class existence inside the house and garden, and now he's coming out into what is now a very run-down streetwise kind of existence with some gangs on the street and that kind of thing. And so I think that the funk jazz joins
his
those two things together.
His version of the monolith moment is encountering the real world instead of the television world.
Well, yes, but I think the main monolith moment is when he gets to the TV shop.
Yeah.
So let me just go back just a second. I think they have to bring in some of the religious symbolism here to make sense of what's being kind of said. And I think we do have the allegory of the Garden of Eden with the garden, because he's a gardener, as Adam, you know, is the sort of priestly figure in the Garden of Eden who tills and keeps the ground. And we have, of course, later in the film, we have Eve, who is the character with whom he doesn't actually form a romantic entanglement, but that's what she wants anyway. So she is likely, you know, the Eve character there, and he is ejected.
Right.
He's ejected from garden.
Yes.
The old man has died, so we there have the Nietzschean sort of God is dead idea. So now Chance is going out from his simplicity, Adamic simplicity, one might say, going out into finding himself in now the difficult, hard world outside of the garden. And he immediately, in the book, it's very immediate. There are a few things in the film that are added, but in the book, it's pretty quick. He's going past a TV shop, and he sees in the window a television for sale, but it's showing himself. He sees himself. He comes to a kind of self-awareness. But he doesn't, because he's a blank, so he doesn't really, but there's the potential to come to a self-awareness at that point. And we just had the Also Sprach Zarathustra music there, and the kind of the death of God kind of idea, the Nietzschean idea, you know. And it's connoting, of course, 2001, where at the end, you know, we have the cosmic child who's born at the end of this kind of evolutionary process. There are so many ideas going on here, and I can't help thinking that it's saying that the chance is somehow coming into his true self, or is having the opportunity to come into his true self at that point. But the thing is, I don't think it's Nietzschean. It's almost like as much an unraveling of some religious ideas as it is unraveling of a critique of those ideas, because Chance, he doesn't become an Übermensch.
Right, exactly.
He's just a blank. So even that reading, that perspectival kind of reading of reality itself is deconstructed. He just continues blankly through the film, and it's everybody else who reads onto him what they want. And so, you know, I feel that the film is all about this business of reading what you want to onto who is presented to you, and saying, look, I think it's saying to us, you know, be careful as you're doing that these are really your own thoughts that you're projecting onto this person who's presented to you. Be careful that your thoughts that you think are your thoughts are not coming from the oligarchy, as it were, or the powers that should not be, who are informing your mind, who are molding your mind through the media, through TV, whatever it is, and you think, ah, yes, this is the person I should respect, this is the person I should give my vote to, this is the person, et cetera, et cetera. Be careful that you are really thinking for yourself. Now, maybe that is my reading of it, and I may be wrong. Maybe Kaczynski is saying, you know, and Lindsay is saying, Ashby is saying, look, you make of it what you like. So maybe I'm just doing that. Maybe
eisegesis
of this text, you know, rather than exegesis.
Right. Well, but on that note, though, it is interesting. You come to essentially the same conclusion as Roger Ebert, who in his summary comes to the conclusion: the movie's implications are alarming. Is it possible that we are all just clever versions of Chance the Gardener? That we are trained from an early age to respond automatically to given words and concepts? That we never really think out much of anything for ourselves, but are content to repeat what works for others in the same situation? And it really does, I think, give the thoughtful viewer pause to reflect on those questions, if they choose to do so. In that context, then, do we read the final, I think probably most famous line of the film, life is a state of mind, do we read that then as a glorification of that concept? We should embrace the fact life is a state of mind and as strive to be a Chance the Gardener? Or is it meant to satirize that idea and to show the hollowness of it?
Yes, I think it works on different levels. I did initially, when I heard that, obviously I thought it was funny, and it is funny. There is the kind of mystic element to it. Life is a state of mind, so if you know, in a kind of new agey way, if you think hard enough, you could even walk on water. You know, you can mold reality, kind of thing. But then there is a deeper analysis of that, where I think it is actually saying to us, yes, indeed, life is about your state of mind. Be careful how you use it, how you interpret reality. And I think this is one of the things that, you know, I think this is why the ending works. And I've so many people say that they don't think it doesn't work, but I think it does, because I think at that moment, the whole thing is flipped around onto us, and we're invited to interpret that last scene completely on our own, because it jars so much with the rest of the film. Although it does weirdly continue some of those quasi-religious symbol things, yeah. Because, I mean, within Christian theology, of course, Jesus would be seen, as far as Paul the Apostle is concerned, as the second Adam. So you have a link there to the beginning. I don't know how much Krasinski would have, you know, thought along those lines.
And he gave parables about gardening, so there you go.
Absolutely, yeah. But I mean, it sort of flips at that point, and I wonder whether at that point we're being challenged to look, you know, beyond the joke that's there, and you know, the challenge is, what do you make of this incongruous scene? Life is a state of mind. Pay attention to how you are actually interpreting it.
Yeah. Well, it certainly it obviously and it completely asks the viewer to at least try to make something of this movie more than just a joke, to reflect on something. It certainly is that kind of incongruous moment. I quite enjoyed that, actually, but yes. I understand a lot of people probably are looking for a more simple and straightforward narrative and are not going to get it here, but that's fine by me. Anyway, I thought it was quite a well-done movie, at any rate, for what that's worth, and it certainly did have embedded in it quite a bit of social commentary and satire, which, as I say, only becomes more stinging inviting as time moves forward, and as we see, as I say, the culmination of this TV soundbite culture in the election cycle we see going on right now. So a lot to take in from this, but I think that pretty much runs the gamut of what I wanted to talk about today. Is there any other aspects of this you wanted to run through?
Oh, good heavens, there are so many things about it that interest me. Of course, as a trained musician, I love the music, and there are other things about the music that interest me, but I don't know whether that's going to just sort of deflate things now that we've talked about, as you say, the meat and potatoes of the film.
Right. Well, yes, perhaps we will leave discussion about the score for another time, but, okay, let me throw in this final nugget, for whatever it's worth, because, strangely enough, so many things seem to revolve around the Laurel Canyon-Charles Manson connection, especially even in the Film Literature New World Order series, where there's the Frankenheimer Manchurian Candidate connection to the Manson murders and JFK and all of that, but... just on that note, Jerzy Kosinski was apparently on his way to Sharon Tate's house the night of the Manson murders and was delayed on his flight in New York, so he didn't make it to Los Angeles. So may have actually escaped being killed himself that night. So, again, just another strange part. But hey, who knows if that's even a true story. So...
This is quite a disorientating experience, James, I have to say. I feel like I'm living inside somebody else's novel, perhaps a mixture of Kosinski and you, so that is very strange.
Well, I'm glad we didn't tie a nice bow on everything here, because that would be much too pat a way to take a look at a movie that's so profoundly disorienting. All right, well, let's wrench ourselves out of this fun, and just for a moment, for people in the audience who don't know about The Mind Renewed, why don't we tell them about your podcast?
Oh, that's very kind of you. Right, okay, what's The Mind Renewed? Well, I call it The Mind Renewed, Thinking Christianly in a New World Order. And that, I think, in some cases, that may put people off because they think it's going to be all about just, I don't know, Christian theology or something like that. But no, basically what I'm doing is, I mean, I am a Christian believer, and I'm trying to explore some of the issues of the age that we live in from my own worldview perspective, which I think, you know, we all do and should do. But in doing that, I'm trying to kind of build some bridges between, I don't really like that phrase, but it serves a purpose. There's so much misunderstanding, I think, between different camps of people out there who are trying to understand the world, that I really want to bring some, I don't really want to be defined by a camp and yet remain faithful to my worldview. So what I'm trying to do, for example, is to implore fellow believers, but this is beyond Christian, to understand that we are actually being having our reality constructed, and we're being lied to in so many ways. And yet at the same time, I'm also trying to appeal to people who are adherents of other belief systems, and saying, look, I and people like me share the same kind of concerns that you do. So you see what I mean? I'm trying to break down some of these, which I think are artificial barriers, yes. Barriers that are constructed by other people to get us, right. You know, arguing against each other. But that doesn't mean, therefore, my podcast and website is saying, well, I'm not going to express anything that I believe. Absolutely not. I think we should express what we believe, but, you know, shake hands with each other where we can, agree where we can, and advance forward where we can. So that's basically what I'm trying to do with the podcast. And I thank you, James, for having come on a couple of times, I think it is, isn't it?
And, yes, indeed. And let me again just say that I really do respect your interview style. I think you really do bring out some very good conversations. And in fact, one of my favorite conversations that I've ever had was our conversation that is up on YouTube, James Corbett Interview, Anatomy of the New World Order. I posted it to the Corbett Report as interview 600. So people can go back and listen to that. I think we got into quite a bit of depth about the structure of the New World Order and how we can really define that and understand that. So that was a very good interview. I hope people will re-listen to that if they've listened to it before or listened to it for the first time, and hopefully start listening to your other interviews on a wide range of subjects, including even occasionally things like being there. So
yes,
hopefully this
true.
Will live thank up you. To the canon of Julian Charles interviews. Well, thank you again for your time. I really do appreciate you coming and sharing your insights into the film.
Well, thank you very much, James, for having me on. It's a great privilege. I've been following your work for many years, and so it's wonderful of you to have me on. Thank you.
Well, there goes Julian Charles of themindrenewed.com, and there goes another edition of Film Literature in the New World Order. But before we wrap things up, as always, let's take a look at the last month's edition of this series, FLNWO number 38, where we talked about the Purge election year with James Evan Pilato of MediaMonarchy.com. Lots of great comments and insights from the Corbett Report members in the crowd, leaving their comments on CorbettReport.com. So let's go through some of those. First, we had M.Claire leaving three different functions that this movie serves in the minds of its viewers. Hyperbolic contrast, i.e. reality is absurd and violence is pretty awful, but hey, at least the real world isn't this bad, right, guys? Be careful what you wish for, i.e. you don't like the police arming themselves like some futuristic Schwarzenegger army? You want anarchy? Well, look what could happen. Uh-oh. And three, desensitization, so that people hardly even react to news of bombings and things like that these days, because, hey, there's so many other distractions and other things going on, and we've seen this script before. Thank you for those comments, M.Claire. I think you hit on three of the important functions that this movie serves. Next up, we have Corbett Report member Nick writing, "Hi, James. Just my two cents on your commentary suggesting that even movies with an anti-war sentiment still glorify war. While I totally agree in most instances, one of my favorite movies, Johnny Got His Gun, I would say, is an exception to this. Maybe the only one. I guess the thing that differentiates it is the sheer amount of time it spends showing the tragedy of war versus the time it shows glorifying it." And thank you for the suggestion, Nick. As a matter of fact, I've never read the novel, I have never seen the stage play, I've never seen the film, Johnny Got His Gun, so that is a good suggestion for me to follow up on. And I think this is a theme that we'll probably return to in this FLNWO series time and again. People might remember my conversation with Brock West talking about Grave of the Fireflies, and is that really an anti-war movie? Because it wasn't intended to be such, but it certainly seemed that way the first time I watched it. It didn't really seem so much an anti-war movie the second time I watched it, interestingly. So sometimes these things can play at multiple levels. So thank you for the suggestion, Nick. I will check that out. SJ Becker 999 leaves the comment, "If Hillary Clinton is progressive, it's because Bernie Sanders got a hold of the Democrat Party platform and his supporters were able to make some changes in exchange for his support." So yes, just to clarify, I hope it didn't come across in that edition of the series that I was actually saying Hillary Clinton is a progressive in the sense that that's generally understood. I certainly didn't mean that. I just meant that the character in the movie is clearly modeled on Clinton and clearly modeled on the idea that Clinton is some sort of progressive reformer or whatever, which of course she isn't. She is neocon, if anything else, but that was the way in which the movie version of this was working, and that was the level of discourse that the movie was portraying. So thank you for that clarification and and reconfirmation of that, SJ Becker 999. Moxa4 leaves the comment, thank you both for your amusing conversation about The Purge. I've enjoyed it quite a bit. I agree with you that this movie, at the end of the day, has to show how important it is to vote. In this case, our vote should go to the quote-unquote politically correct candidate, of course. And yes, I think that is reaffirming the political narrative that we're expected to take from this film. Corporate Report member Jumping Oranges leaves the comment, The Purge is about the anger-slash-revenge authoritarian or violence to solve differences or resolve problems, which doesn't work, and sadly the show isn't a comedy. Well, you're exactly right about that. And then Jumping Oranges leaves some comments, some suggestions for various viewing along that line of the authoritarian revenge fantasy kind of movies, fantasy violence that unfortunately we're probably all too familiar with. Teraba leaves the comment, you hit the nail right on the head when you mentioned the idea of The Purge glorifying violence. Hollywood, like music and every other form of entertainment, is a tool to establish reality, build a narrative. It rests below the general story. But when you look at Hollywood as a whole, or the movie industry, you see the narrative, its divisiveness, its use of violence to resolve conflict, its fear of the people who are different, all the while acting like it is doing just the opposite. So thank you for that, Teraba. I think that's a good way of articulating one of the key points that I keep coming back to, which is that no matter what these movies on the surface level appear to be trying to aim at, I think there is another level in which they're operating. And that's certainly true in this Purge propaganda. Home Remedy Supply, our resident Texan activist, leaves some a lot of different links on the Dallas police shooting, which he posits as one of the sources of The Purge, or at least, I would say, at least a mirror of The Purge kind of idea, and something that really did, I think, tip over this year into that, into the Summer of Rage, which is leading into the fall of the Empire, the Republic, whatever. Whatever is going on in this circus selection cycle. Russell.m leaves an interesting comment. The basic idea behind Purge is not exactly new or original. Gene Roddenberry of Star Trek fame used a similar plot in a Star Trek episode, Return of the Archons, in 1967, which, growing up as a Trekkie in a Trek-watching household, I never thought to connect Return of the Archons to this movie, but I guess you're right. There is a festival going on in that episode. Although, I guess if we really want to stretch it back, I mean, the idea of carnival as the kind of pre-Lent festival goes back hundreds, thousands of years in European history, and before that, of course, we have Bacchanalia and all of those kinds of festivities. Lots of different cultures have that time, that period where laws are inverted and roles and social order is overturned. So I think there are very deep roots in the collective unconscious for this type of idea, this suspension of all rules. And I think that's one of the things that this movie series is obviously playing on. Corbett Report member Keddy leaves the note, I watched all three films in preparation, low-level propaganda and dumb storylines aside. They were entertaining. And fair enough. I wouldn't argue with that. If you're entertained, I don't hold that against you. I'm not some kind of snob turning my nose up at things like this. For people who understand these things as entertainment and view them in that way, knowing the propaganda that's at work and deflecting and defending yourself against it, I'm not going to hold that against anyone. So if you do enjoy this type of movie, well, by all means, enjoy it. Just be aware of what's going on is, I think, the minimum of what we can say about it. And then finally, Orenda Review writes, your comment about violence and human nature reminded me of a critique you might be interested in exploring. David Graeber wrote a short book called Fragments of an Anarchist Anthropology, where he addressed the question of violence in anarchist societies. And then Orenda Review leaves a note, a comment with a link to the book itself. So thank you very much for that. I will check into that. I haven't read enough Graeber. I've read fragments of the Fragments of an Anarchist Anthropology, but not the whole thing. So that should be on my reading list as well. So I think that about does it for the comments from last time. As always, Corbett Report members are invited, nay, exhorted, to leave your comments on this conversation and on this movie in the comment section at CorbettReport.com. Of course, Corbett Report members, for as little as $1 a month, get login access, so you can go and leave your comments there in the comment section and join the conversation. And it's going to be an interesting conversation this month, talking about this very interesting movie, and, well, in preparation for a very interesting book next month. Next month, we are going to be talking about American Tabloid by James Elroy. The link will be in the show notes as always. Happy reading.
The Corbett Report is brought to you by The Corbett Report Subscriber, a weekly newsletter featuring James Corbett's International Forecaster editorial, recommended reading and viewing, discounts on Corbett Report DVDs, and once a month, a subscriber-only video. Sign up today to start receiving your copy at corbettreport.com/support.